Yes, a corn with cookies.
More cookies.
Yes.
Oh, those are good.
All right, the meeting of Nevada Tahoe Conservation District will come to order. Supervisor roll call.
Let the record be known that Supervisors Smith, Penzel, McCarthy, Cook, and Martin are all present.
Pledge of allegiance. I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all. Item four, approval of agenda. Are there any modifications?
Move to approve.
Is there a second?
Second.
It's been moved and seconded. All in favor, say aye.
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 Aye. Then ask for extensions. Public interest comments.
I have one.
Yes, Bob.
In the Tahoe Tribune, I talked to Mark about it at the post office, but I wanted to bring the article in. Tahoe Tribune, Saturday, October 31st, they were talking about protecting the Tahoe Yellow Crest plant. No mention of Nevada Tahoe Conservation District and their involvement. Also, I received that paper from the, I don't know if it's from the league or whoever, the TRPA, whoever it is. The address is, I meant to bring it and I forgot when I left. It's sitting on my desk. I just got it last night in the post office. I don't know if it's, like I say, TRPA or who puts it out. Like I say, it's a state line Nevada returning address, whoever it is.
That's TRPA.
12 or 14, who is it?
That's TRPA, the league.
Hold on, Barbara, I'm trying to turn up the phone.
Barbara?
What's the name of the publication, do you know?
Lake Tahoe In Depth.
That was it, for sure.
Yeah, TRPA organizes it on behalf of all the agencies.
It's very informative, but again, there was an article in there about the Tahoe Yellow Crest. No mention of Nevada Tahoe Conservation District, and I just thought that it was a perfect opportunity for us to get exposure, especially when we're talking about SB 476. That's my comment. So you can have this article if you'd like.
Thank you.
Thank you, Bob.
Any other public comment?
Barbara, I'm trying to turn up the speaker so you can be heard.
Who do we have?
I think Barbara, but my speaker's broken. Maybe. I'm not going to be able to hear my phone on the phone.
Can she hear you? I can.
Barbara, are you there? Okay, I've got a problem with my volume. Maureen's going to log in just a second here.
Oh, you want me to call the line or you want me to just call her?
You're the only one. Do you want to be on phone with Maureen and use her speakerphone or with the general conference line?
It might be easier.
Okay.
It'd be easier just to unlock it.
Yeah.
What do you want to do?
Have her hang up.
She said what?
Have her hang up and I'll call her.
Yeah.
Ask her what number.
All right, what's your number, Barbara? Okay.
Mark, did you bring the speakerphone?
Can you say something right now? I might have got my speaker going.
We did, but it doesn't work with any of our phones.
Are you there, Barbara?
In here. But it might work with hers.
What, mine?
Yeah. Do you have Bluetooth, I assume?
I do.
So if you turn on Bluetooth, it should connect.
Poor technology really helps us, doesn't it?
Well, it's just in here, the reception's terrible.
I've got lots of signal.
Okay.
I got AT&T. And that's one thing they can do in Douglas County. Is that on?
It's on.
Is it blinking?
It is not. Oh, something happened there.
Well, tell her that.
While we're waiting for the.
So Maureen's going to call.
Tell her to.
To stay on the line.
I don't know where I heard.
Yeah, stay on the line. Maureen's going to call the conference line, Barbara.
I thought you had like a Christmas party to go to.
Oh, that's a star.
You know what? I think we will go on. There's no further public comment at this time. There's also public comment at the end of the agenda.
She could just log in and write over.
Let's go on to item six, which is approval of the fiscal year 2015 annual audit. So Beth.
All right. Well, thanks for having me here today. A couple of things you guys received. One is the reporting audit package. and then there's a two-page letter. So the
connect
two-page letter.
JabraLink 360.
There we go.
The two-page letter is just required board communication. So these are things that we're required to report to you guys as the board members. As if there's any difficulties or disagreements, what the major disclosures are, those types of things. Of course, we're always happy to report that with you guys, there's no disagreements or difficulties in the audit process. One of the things that we do talk about, and we're going to concentrate quite a bit on, is that first one of those first paragraphs that talks about GASB statement number 68 and the acceptance of that new standard, accounting standards, and how that has an effect on there. So if you guys have flipped through this, you have probably seen quite a large number effect that that's had on your financial statements this year. So we'll go over in detail what that means to you. So that is a major thing this year that we'll talk about. Does anybody have any questions or comments on that standard language?
No.
Okay. The other thing to notate is that there were no corrected or uncorrected misstatements that we came across during the audit process. So that's a good thing as well.
Way to go, Mark.
Yes.
Yes.
And all of staff.
Yeah. Look and see. All right, so we'll go ahead and jump in to here, and I'll just kind of go through and highlight some of the things I want to talk about. But if you have questions or anything, don't hesitate to holler out and tell me to stop. So right after the table of contents is the independent auditor's report, and this is a clean or unmodified opinion. So that's a good thing, because that means that there was no modifications for these financial statements to be in accordance with generally accepted accounting standards. We again, it gets mentioned a lot. So again, there's a change in accounting principle that has to be highlighted, that there was a new change this year. So we'll see that as we go through. Page 4 is the management discussion and analysis. So the first page of that kind of goes through the government-wide financial statements and the fund financial statements and what the differences between those two are. And just as a quick reminder, government-wide is a full accrual basis. So that's everything that you have as an asset, everything you have as a liability, regardless of when it would be received or needed to be paid. Whereas the fund financial statements are current resources. So if you received it within first 60 days, or those resources you had in those first 60 days were liable to pay that liability, then it would be included. So it's a little bit of a different basis, and those are both reported throughout the report, the financial statements. On page 6, those are a couple of things that is required that management talk about, economic factors and potential changes. Yes, absolutely.
Back to page 4.
Yeah.
Financial highlights. That sounds like a highlight, sounds like a low light.
Yes.
And it shows a decrease of about $75,000. But then you said the district had a total revenue of $2,104,854 and program expenses of $2,108,547. So, in other words, the expenses for the programs exceeded the revenue.
Only by about $4,000. And that's why I wasn't going to spend a lot of time on this, because I think it makes a lot more sense to look at your financials. Because you're
between the pension decrease and this decrease, or the pension increase and this decrease, is that what accounts for that $75,000?
Well, there's actually the decrease is the close. It was 828. It was a decrease of 951,000. It wasn't actually a decrease of 75,000. That's just the difference between those two numbers. But it was actually a decrease of 951. But part of it is a prior period adjustment, so it doesn't get recognized in expenses this year. It takes your net assets from the prior year and goes to prior period adjustment, and then here's what it is. So it was a very significant one. But I think you have to really see the whole financial statements to really understand what that means. And there is a quick summary on here on the page 5 where you can see that $951,000, the very next page, change decrease, because the net position in 2014 was $123,000, and now it's a negative of $828,000. But the biggest change in that was about $900,000 was a change in prior period adjustment due to the net pension. So I think it's probably good if we just go ahead and talk about what that is instead of getting into all the numbers and kind of do an overview of what that GASB was, so that everybody understands that.
So just follow on with that. You're going to now explain what the accounting principal pension expense change was?
Yes.
Perfect.
So what it was is that obviously PERS across the nation, all the different states have PERS. And there's a big concern nationwide that these liabilities aren't showing up on anybody's financial statements. They show up on PERS, and you kind of can see them on there. But anybody who's looking at local government financial statements, they don't see that potential impact of what that is. And what does that mean for each of the local governments? Now, there is some argument from local governments that that's not our responsibility because we're responsible to pay our percentage. Every month, we, you know, when we have salaries, we pay the percentage. We don't have any responsibility to pay that outstanding liability. Well, if you think about it this way, that is true. But on the flip side of it, where does PERS get their money from? They only get it from that percentage. They only get it from all the local governments. So if they're short, the only place for them to make that up is by increasing their rates. So you have a potential long-term liability in the fact that your rates are probably going to go up. And so you need to start thinking about how you're going to deal with that at this point. And that's really the current effect on the local governments. No, you're not going to go write a check for $892,000.
It's a requirement to set aside.
It's not necessarily a requirement to set aside either. It's just something that needs to be brought to each of the local government's attention to realize that PERS doesn't have enough money right now based on actuarial assumptions to pay all of those liabilities. Now, there's a lot of things that go into those actuary assumptions.
That would really mean that the rate that the employees pay would go up. So their net income would go down.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And it takes an act of the legislature to do that. We just don't, the PERS is set by the legislature, not by us.
Right, right.
So if they want to change the shortfall, it's the legislature that does it, and the impact is to the employee.
Correct, yeah. So, but there's a lot of things that go into that. What PERS did is they had to have an audit. This was the first year they had to do that. So the audit was done as of the fiscal year June 3014. So that's what the numbers are that you guys are seeing is your allocated portion of that for June 3014. So what goes into that number? They took all of the employees that are currently employed, all the employees that are currently retired, their date of hires, their expected date of death, their expected date of retirement, what's our expected rate of returns. So there's a lot of moving numbers in that. So a lot of people argue, well, that's just an actuarial number. I mean, so many things can change from that, obviously, from year to year. So last year, so what happened is they did an audit. They audited the numbers June 30, 14, and then audited the numbers as June 30, 14 to see the difference. So your guys' June 30, 13 number was $1,063,000, and your June 30, 14 number was $842,000. So that actually dropped between those 2 years. So we'll kind of have to play it by ear and see. And the other things that go into that as well is, if you have a big contraction, a lot of governments are laying off, they're going to get less current contributions into PERS. So that means that liability is going to increase. Now, some local governments maybe are hiring, so then they have more contributions, and then that liability decreases. So there's just so much that goes into it. It's a good place to start to think about it. But it doesn't really, it's not a good number that says, I know that we're going to have to pay this additional $842,000 over the next some number of years.
So what do we do with that information? Because like Doug said, I mean, it's not like we have control over how much the pension.
You have absolutely no control. And the numbers that you see in here came straight from PERS. How they calculated it is they figured out all these numbers. They took your contributions for June 30, 14 as a percentage of the total. And then they used that percentage against all of those numbers. So the numbers are, they come to you guys as a local government. You have no control over what numbers get put into your financial statements. They're required. I think what we've seen over the years is the pension rate has changed. It's 25, correct me if I'm wrong, 25.7.
It's 28%.
28% now. As it keeps changing every year. It's gone up significantly. It was 20%, 22%, 25%, 28%. So that's a very large percentage of somebody's salary that's going into that. And I think that's the concern is that it's going to increase that rate.
And don't forget, also, the legislature has also reduced the benefit to the retiree.
Absolutely.
Over time, too.
Yes.
And you would know this.
I would know this. but it all has to do with your hire date. And
yes.
What they do is they can't retroactively go back to somebody who was hired 20 years ago. But they can go and say anything that's hired from this date forward will have a pension. Now I think it's at 2% per year. And at one point, it was 2.67% per year. And all depends on when you were hired.
Yeah.
So they adjust two things, the amount that we pay and also the amount that gets paid to the retiree.
So,
but
so
as a manager.
Right. Thank you. Exactly.
If you look on page 5, I think the number that you got to look at is revenues and expenses, and then the change in that position is just advisory information.
Exactly.
Yes.
Yeah.
But I'd like to ask a question.
Yeah.
You said about 8 or 9 years ago they came out with Gatsby. It was the Gatsby 35.
Mm-hmm.
And that was all about funding or unfunded liabilities and recognizing those and then funding them moving. It was all about actuaries.
Well,
so why didn't this get recognized in that?
There was a two things that didn't get picked up in that, and that was your PEBS and your PERS, so your post-employment benefit system. Yeah, and those were, and that was the thing, is that it was.
Why did they not get picked up in that? That was the whole purpose of it.
Well, and it was 34 was the original one too that that brought in fixed assets. So now that's why you have the two sets of books, or almost where you've got the fund financials and the government wide that you're reporting on, because the argument was is that some people thought we should only see government-wide because that's important to see full accrual, where local governments are like, but we only work on current resources. If we don't have that, you know, we're going to pay for it or we're not going to pay for it because we have the cash. So it's not, it doesn't mean as much to us as a local government. So that's why you end up having to show both. And that was just not something that was as large of a concern. So I don't know. I mean, I don't work for GASB, so I don't know what their thought process was at that time, but... Yeah. So let's look at...
And not to belabor this any more than necessary, but one thing that it doesn't say here and is kind of hidden behind all this is the fact that people who don't work the number of years to get vested, that a portion of their share that gets put into PERS is retained by PERS. A case in point was Marilyn Williams, who used to be Mark... 6 years ago, 7 years ago now, Mark?
Eight years.
I'm thinking more like 8, yeah.
Well, she left just months away from being vested.
Yeah.
And so she gave up all of that money that the district had put into PERS. And that's kind of a hidden thing of PERS and how they are able to meet their liability. When they look at this number, they look at everybody who's employed. They don't look at the turnover of those under the vestment period, which I think is now 10 years rather than it used to be 5.
Yeah.
So that's significant.
Yeah. But she still could have captured a cash amount.
She took the cash amount of what she put in.
Right.
But what we put in as the match stays there.
Yeah. And so, yeah, so as a management, at how you guys manage this is you still manage it the same way you were doing before, is looking at your cash budget. You know, what do you guys have coming in? What do you have to pay out? And typically, by the time you're doing your budget for the next fiscal year, you know what that rate's going to be. So you're doing that. But I think it's more of just kind of a long-term focus is looking at, okay, long-term for the district, you're going to probably expect to see that increase. That's our assumption. But we don't really know.
Yeah, but it's going to come not to us in particular. It's going to come to every state.
Absolutely.
So what do you do with it, Barry, in Douglas County?
Well, I look at what I was talking about. I mean, if you look at what we have in revenue and expenses in the middle of this thing, statement of activities on page 5, it shows that grants were $2,104,000 and change in 2015 versus $1,257,014. This tells me that Jason has been more active in obtaining grant revenue than before. And I think that's a laudable thing. It also, if you look at expenses, salaries and benefits were down $30,000, while service and supplies expenses were up a million, basically, or 900,000. Depreciation was down, so the net total expenses was 1,000,002, and the difference between the revenue and the expenses, as Beth was saying,
yeah, it's only $3,600.
$3,600. Now, while that's not good, it does mean that we're bringing in more revenue. We've got to look at the expenses in terms of services and supplies. Mm-hmm. But Jason's doing an admirable job of getting more money into the NTCD coffer, which is a lot of the things since he's also trying to be an engineer on the projects. And I think he's done a great job.
Hold that thought.
It's too much, because that 1.4 million you got there on services.
Has a lot of contractors.
It was contractors.
Yes, there was the
problem we have
construction project.
Is we aren't able to capture much of a portion of that pass through revenue.
Yeah.
What did we capture of that in our general fund, if anything? Do you know, Mark? Beth?
Oh, the subcontractor?
The subcontractors get pulled out.
We don't charge anything.
I know. See, and that's the problem.
We don't charge
a penny off of that 1.4 million.
But see, that's an area where we focus. We now know an area to focus on.
Yeah,
yeah.
It's an opportunity.
Well, I know that, and that's a discussion I want to have later. You know,
yeah.
How
much later?
Well, it's in
the... Later today. Later this morning.
Douglas County charges 3% administration fee. It's only 3%, but 3% of $1 million.
Well, there's an indirect cost rate calculation that's done that Mark does on an annual basis. And so there's a flat percentage that's charged to all of your grants. And in the calculation of that, both during the request for the percentage and then also in the billing of it, it pulls out all the subcontractors. And the reason why that does is because, you know, one year you've got 300,000 in subcontractors, and the next year you've got 800,000 subcontractors. It makes that rate really not, it skews it quite a bit up and down to where it's not manageable to use. And so you pull that out to try to keep that rate percentage more reasonable, but then you're not pulling it on the 2.1 million, you're only probably pulling on 1.5 or 1.3, that rate. And it was...
It is 37 point something right
37.
Now.
37.7. So you guys are getting 37% on all of your grant revenue unless it's billed for subcontractors.
Yeah, which is the major, which is a big chunk of it.
It is a big chunk, yeah.
So you're getting IDC only on that which gets retained in the district,
right.
Not on anything that goes out.
Right.
And that is not how other organizations have the flexibility of charging either a pass-through on a total percentage or at least put IDC on the first. You know, the university does IDC on the first, I think it's 25,000.
Well, so the indirect costs don't change. And I mean, and everyone kind of does it differently, but if the subcontractors were in there, it would probably drop that indirect cost rate down to like 20-something percent. Mm-hmm. So you may end up with the same amount, because your indirect costs are what they are. They don't go up because you have subcontractors. So you have, say you have $300,000 of indirect costs during the year, you're gonna have $300,000 of indirect costs regardless. And there's a 2-year look back period. It sounds like you're very familiar with what they do, but mm-hmm. but it just drops that rate if you include them. And it's fine in an organization where you have pretty consistent numbers, but when you have the numbers that go up and down so significantly like this one does, it makes it harder for that percentage to work for you.
Through that, Barry?
We're just getting to our audited report, this meeting.
Well,
this is ours. And they gave it to us 2 days ago.
Oh.
So... And to answer your question, what do we do with it?
Next meeting, you'll tell us.
Beth, while we're on that number right there, that 1.4 million of contractors, is there any way under our current rules and structures with our grants to change how we get to make some revenue off of that? The only way we make revenue off of that right now is by calculating the indirect expense. Then people who don't have a subcontractor component are actually helping to pay for the cost of managing all that pass-through money. Does that make sense, what I just said?
I do get where you're coming from.
So is there a way under our current rules that enables us to go back to some type of 3% administrative fee on all subcontractors?
Well, So the way that it works is that the indirect cost rate has to be approved by your cognizant agency in advance, and you can only use that one, that rate, unless, and so what the recommendation would be is to talk to your cognizant agency and ask about how, because I think years ago you guys didn't exclude the subcontractors.
Correct. We did not, yeah.
And so there was a time that it wasn't being done that way. And so you can go and say, how do we do that? But you've got it, because there's this 2-year look back period, it's not an easy straight across kind of way to do that. But it is something that you could look at changing how that calculation is done and talking to them how they would recommend you guys doing that and if they would allow it. It's whether or not they allow it too.
And the other way to change that is, I believe a portion of that 1.4 million is, let's just take the Burke Rave project. I believe a significant portion of that has been fed to, and maybe feeding is not the right term, has been contracted to engineering support.
Right.
And isn't one of the things we can do is, if we have the expertise in-house, instead of passing that through,
yeah,
retain it in-house?
Yeah, of course.
Yo, yeah. That's our call.
Yeah, that's absolutely.
Well, I know, and it was the project manager's call to pass that through, and I'm just saying maybe we should
educate your project managers
clearly
to make sure they understand.
Clearly, you can't go back in history, but you can certainly go forward with not allowing project managers without a justification that gets passed by this board to pass out an engineering subcontractor. They have to prove to us that we don't have the expertise in-house.
Yeah, I agree with that.
Or that there may be a conflict of interest, like with Burke Creek, since we're project proponent, for us to do the NEPA documentation.
Mm-hmm.
It made sense, and the Forest Service recommended that we don't do it, and we subcontract that out.
Then there's
so
the
that's why. For that example, because I talked to Michael Pook about that same thing, of, hey, let's try and keep this in-house, the NEPA process, and Forest Service had said it's better if you're not the one, because the review is going to be different. Right. The design components possibly would be a great one to keep in-house.
Yeah, so there are things we can do to retain the funds in-house, and obviously we put over IDC on that. But there is a justification in that the university certainly uses, which is, you charge IDC on a small percentage, a fixed dollar amount, right? So the university charges IDC on subcontracts. They charge IDC on the first 25,000. And the justification is, and that's 43%, 0.5%. Mm. The justification is that's the cost that it takes you to manage the subcontracting process, whether it's an RFP process or it's your contract officers managing it. And that. So, but you always know what that's going to be, because it's a fixed, it's your fixed IDC rate. So for us, it would be whatever, 38 point something. But you only charge it on the first $25,000 that go out the door. That gives you at least a little bit of revenue back to cover the cost of managing those subs.
And that's rightfully something the board should decide, because that's a policy matter going forward.
I'm not sure the board can decide that. I think we would have to...
Anything. You have to talk to your cognizant agency.
But it
would
have to be part of the agreement.
Yes, you would have to. You guys want to pursue that, and then they can. Mark can work with them in that process, because you're probably...
I can just tell you, the answer would be no.
Mm-hmm. NDSL, for example, to bring out a very good and representation of what's going on. NDSL, we used to have indirect on our subcontracts. NDSL, at that point, I think it was a 5% indirect. Do you remember this, Doug? It was 3 or 5. It's still 3.
Uh-huh.
We can choose now, NDSL has told us, we can choose to take 3% on the whole grant. So if we had a $5 million grant, we can take 3% indirect cost rate, or we can take no indirect cost rate on the subcontractors and our normal about 37%
on labor, right?
On NTCD wages
expenses.
And labor and expenses. So they've given us the choice, NDSL. And usually when I'm putting in my proposals, I run both to see which one brings more to the district.
Yeah.
So one of them, and it's about a $20,000 grant, let's say, with subcontractors, that you need to have a higher dollar than that to break even. So when it comes into maybe a $100,000 grant, it's probably worth taking the $3,000.
So then it's going to come down to a question of, do we take that or not? You know, it doesn't do anybody any good if we lose money on it.
Right.
Correct.
It doesn't make sense.
Yeah, but they can do it. They can do the calculation.
Yeah, I figured out first to figure out which is going to bring more into our general fund. Then we take that, and yes, that means Mark would have had to readjust my salary if we had a $500,000 subcontract. Well, we'd rather get the 3% on that subcontract than the 37% on my $4,000 for managing the project.
See, and that was my point that I'm trying to get to, is the fact that we should not allow any subcontracting of engineers or hydrologists until we've demonstrated that we have to do that. Mm-hmm. And this board can tell our staff to do that. And that way, if you're designing something and we have two engineers who have those capabilities, you can't do it unless this board authorizes it. So you have to come. I think that's part of our problem right now, is we've farmed out some work and lost labor revenue.
But, we do have to understand that there's a finite number of hours that our staff can work. So,
may I propose it? Really, this is a discussion we don't need to have
with the others.
Maybe we should continue to the.
There were some good ideas laid out here, though.
Yeah. I think we need to go back and revisit that. But
business
I think we
status
we
item this. 7. Yeah. Okay.
And in that regard. Maureen, one of the things that I think is important is at the very end, it's findings, and there are no findings.
True.
Yes.
Yeah. Again. That's a good thing. Again. That is a very good thing.
We like that.
We do.
Excuse me, I apologize. Why don't we kind of go through that real quick? Well, I'm going to go through the notes. Let's look at the notes for the pensions. Page 15, 16, 17, and 18 are all the new notes for the pensions. And in all that we were talking about, if you look at page 18, it shows the net pension liability at 8% discount rate, but you're also required to show what it would have been with a 7% discount rate or a 9% discount rate, and you can see it changes from 1.3 million to 842 to 454. So you can see how so much of this actuarial number can change based off of just one number change in those assumptions. So that's crucial to understand too in this whole process and discussion of it. If we go back to page 21, your proportion of the net pension liability was 0.00809% of the total. Just kind of gives you guys an idea of what the where you guys land in that. it's a very, very small percentage. On page 23 is your statement of revenue expenditures and changes in fund balance, budget to actual. I think this is more what you guys need to be looking at in the operational side of it. You know, where was our budget? Where are we looking at there? You had total revenue of $1.2 million budgeted, and your actual was $2.1 million. And this one will break it down so that we can see on the expenditures, your project costs were $494,000 budgeted. And in 2014, they were 481, but your actual for 2015 was 1.37. So that has that big, even though you see that big amount of revenue going up and you see that big amount of expenditures, that project cost, which is mostly also passed through, was such a large increase there. Whereas your employee salary dropped slightly from prior year, fringe benefits went down as well. Page 24 is your statement of federal awards. So you guys had 1.4 in federal awards this year. As a reminder, for next fiscal year, if you guys have less than $750,000, you will not be required to do a single audit. So that kind of depends on where you end up every single year. So it's now bumped up from the $500,000 limit to the $750,000. That's federal dollars only, yeah. So you can have a lot more state, but definitely just federal.
Let me ask you, if we were doing project work with NDOT, NDOT gets a portion of their money from state highway taxes.
Doesn't
and
matter.
Some from federal costs.
They're required to tell you what they're giving you. They are required to tell you, and it can sometimes be a split. Sometimes they'll give you a half and half, but they are required.